Flashman at the Charge by George MacDonald Fraser, continued. Cassette 3, side 2.
"Tell him," says he, baring his teeth in a savage grin. "By Christ, I told him 3 times over, as if that bastard needs telling to act defensively. He's capable of nothing else. Well, he's got his bloody orders. Now let's see how he carries them out." And with that he went over to Tubby Morris, and I thought, well, that's that. Now for the sapoon, home and beauty, and let them chase to their heart's content down here. And I was just wheeling my horse when from behind me I heard Lucan's voice. "Colonel Flashman," he was sitting with Cardigan before the 13th lights, "come over here, if you please." "Now what?" thinks I, and my belly gave a great windy twinge as I trotted over towards them. Lucan was snapping at him impatiently as I drew alongside. I know, but there it is. Lord Raglan's order is quite positive, and we must obey it." "Oh, very well," says Cardigan, damned ill-humoured. His voice was a mere croak, no doubt with his rupee chest, or over-boozing on his yacht. He flicked a glance at me and looked away, sniffing. Lucan addressed me. "You will accompany Lord Cardigan," says he. "In the event that communication is needed, he must have a galloper." I stared, horrified, hardly taking in Cardigan's comment. "I envisage no necessity for Colonel Flashman's presence or for communication with your lordship." "Indeed, sir," says I. "Lord Raglan will need me. I dare not wait any longer. With your lordship's permission, I..." "You will do as I say," barks Lucan. "Upon my word, I've never met such insolence from mere gallopers before this day. First Nolan, and now you. Do as you're told, sir, and let us have none of this shirking." And with that he wheeled away, leaving me terrified, enraged, and baffled. What could I do? Couldn't disobey. It just wasn't possible. He had said I must ride with Cardigan to those damned redoubts, chasing Raglan's bloody guns. My God, after what I'd been through already. In an instant, by pure chance, I'd been snatched from security and thrust into the melting pot again. It wouldn't do. I turned to Cardigan, the last man I'd have appealed to in any circumstances except an extremity like this. "My lord," says I, "this is preposterous, unreasonable. Lord Raglan will need me. Will you speak to his lordship? He must be made to see." "If there's one thing," says Cardigan in that croaking drawl, "of which I'm tolerably certain in this uncertain world, it is the total impossibility of making my ward Wonkin see anything at all. He makes it queer, furthermore, that there's no discussion of his orders."
He looked me up and down.
"You heard him, sir. Take station behind me and to my weft. Believe me, I do not welcome your presence here any more than you do yourself."
At that moment up came George Paget, my cheroot clamped between his teeth.
"We are to advance, Lord George," says Cardigan. "I shall need close support, do you hear? Your very best support, Lord George. You understand me?"
George took the cheroot from his mouth, looked at it, stuck it back, and then said very stiff, "As always, my lord, you shall have my support."
Very well," says Cardigan,
and they turned aside, leaving me stricken and nicely hoist with my own petard, you'll agree. Why hadn't I kept my mouth shut in Raglan's presence? I could have been safe and comfy up in the sapoon, but no, I'd had to try to vent my spite to get Cardigan in the way of a bullet, and the result was I'd be facing the bullets alongside him. Oh, a skirmish round-gun redoubts is a small enough thing by military standards, unless you happen to be taking part in it, and I reckoned I'd used up 2 of my 9 lives today already. To make matters worse, my stomach was beginning to churn and heave most horribly again. I sat there, with me back to the light brigade, nursing it miserably, while behind me the orders rattled out and the squadrons reformed. I took a glance round and saw the 17th were now directly behind me, 2 little clumps of lances, with the cherry-pickers in behind. And here came Cardigan trotting out in front, glancing back at the silent squadrons. He paused, facing them, and there was no sound now but the restless thump of hooves and the creak and jingle of the gear. All was still, 5 regiments of cavalry looking down the valley, with Flashy out in front, wishing he were dead, and suddenly aware that dreadful things were happening under his belt. I moved, gasping gently to myself, stirring on my saddle, and suddenly,
Without the slightest volition on my part, there was the most crashing discharge of wind, like the report of a mortar. My horse started. Cardigan jumped in his saddle, glaring at me, and from the ranks of the 17th a voice muttered, "Christ, as if Russian artillery wasn't bad enough!" Someone giggled, and another voice said, "We've had Whistling Dick, now we got Trumpeting Harry and all." "Silence!" cries Cardigan, looking like thunder, and the murmur in the ranks died away. And then, God help me, in spite of my straining efforts to contain myself, there was another fearful bang beneath me, echoing off the saddle, and I thought Cardigan would explode with fury. I could not merely sit there. "I beg your pardon, my lord," says I. "I'm not well." "Be silent," snaps he, and he must have been in a highly nervous condition himself, otherwise he would never have added in a hoarse whisper, "Can you not contain yourself, you disgusting fella?" "My lord," whispers I cannot help it. It is the feverish wind, you see." And I interrupted myself yet again, thunderously. He let out a fearful oath under his breath and wheeled his charger, his hand raised. He croaked out, "Brigade will advance. First Squadron, 17th. Walk, march, trot." And behind us the squadron stirred and moved forward, 700 cavalry. One of them palsied with fear, but in spite of that, feeling a mighty relief internally. It was what I'd needed all day, of course, like these sheep that stuff themselves on some windy weed and have to be pierced to get them right again. And that was how it began. Ahead of me I could see the short turf of the valley turn into plough, and beyond that the haze at the valley end, a mile and more away, and only a few hundred yards off, on either side, the enclosing slopes, with the small figures of Russian infantry clearly visible. You could even see their artillerymen wheeling the guns round and scurrying among the limbers. We were well within range, but they were watching, waiting to see what we would do next. I forced myself to look straight ahead down the valley. There were guns there in plenty, and squadrons of Cossacks flanking them. Their lance points and sabres caught the sun and threw it back in a thousand sudden gleams of light. Would they try a charge when we wheeled right towards the redoubts? Would Cardigan deploy the 4th Lights? Would he put the 17th forward as a screen when we made our flank movement? If I stuck close by him, would I be all right? Oh, God, how had I landed in this fix again? 3 times in a day. It wasn't fair. It was unnatural. And then my innards spoke again, resoundingly. And perhaps the Russian gunners heard it, for far down the causeway on the right a plume of smoke blossomed out as though in reply. There was the crash of the discharge, and the shot went screaming overhead, and then from all along the causeway burst out a positive salvo of firing. There was an orange flash and a huge bang 100 paces ahead, and a fount of earth was hurled up and came pattering down before us, while behind there was the crash of exploding shells and a new barrage opening up from the hills on the left. Suddenly it was, as Lord Tennyson tells us, like the very jaws of hell. I realized that, without noticing, I'd started to canter, babbling gently to myself, and in front Cardigan was cantering too, but not as fast as I was. One celebrated account remarks that, in his eagerness to be first at grips with the foe, Flashman was seen to forge ahead. Ah, we can guess the fierce spirit that burned in that manly breast. I don't know about that, but I'm here to inform you that it was nothing to the fierce spirit that burned in my manly bowels. There was a crash, crash, crash of flaming bursts across the front and the scream of shell splinters whistling by. Cardigan shouted, "Steady!" But his own charger was pacing away now, and behind me the clatter and jingle was being drowned by the rising drum of hooves, from a slow canter to a fast one, and then to a slow gallop. And I tried to rein in that little mare, smothering my own panic and snarling fiercely to myself, "Wheel, wheel, for God's sake, why doesn't the stupid bastard wheel?" For we were level with the first Russian redoubt. Their guns were leveled straight at us, not 400 yards away. The ground ahead was being torn up by shot. And then from behind me there was a frantic shout. I turned in the saddle, and there was Nolan, his sabre out, charging across behind me, shouting hoarsely, "Wheel, my lord! Not that way! Wheel! To the redoubts!" His voice was all but drowned in the tumult of explosion, and then he was streaking past Cardigan, reining his beast back on its haunches, his face livid as he turned to face the brigade. He flourished his sabre and shouted again, and a shell seemed to explode dead in front of Cardigan's horse. For a moment I lost Nolan in the smoke, and then I saw him, face contorted in agony, his tunic torn open and gushing blood from shoulder to waist. He shrieked horribly, and his horse came bounding back towards us, swerving past Cardigan with Lou toppling forward onto the neck of his mount. As I stared back, horrified, I saw him careering into the gap between the Lancers and the 13th Light, and then they'd swallowed him, and the squadrons came surging down towards me. I turned to look for Cardigan. He was 30 yards ahead, tugging like damnation to hold his charger in, with a shot crashing all about him. "Stop!" I screamed. "Stop, for Christ's sake, man! Rein in!" For now I saw what Lou had seen. The fool was never going to wheel. He was taking the Light Brigade straight into the heart of the Russian army, towards those massive batteries at the valley foot that were already belching at us, while the cannon on either side were raking us from the flanks, trapping us in a terrible enfilade that must smash the whole command to pieces. "Stop, damn you!" I yelled again, and was in the act of wheeling to shout at the squadrons behind, when the earth seemed to open beneath me in a sheet of orange flame. I reeled in the saddle, deafened. The horse staggered, went down, and recovered, with myself clinging for dear life, and then I was grasping nothing but loose reins. The bridle was half gone. My brute had a livid gash, spouting blood along her neck. She screamed and hurtled madly forward, and I seized the mane to prevent myself being thrown from the saddle. Suddenly I was level with Cardigan. We bawled at each other, he waving his sabre, and now there were blue tunics level with me either side. And the lance points of the 17th were thrusting forward with the men crouched low in the saddles. It was an inferno of bursting shell and whistling fragments of orange flame and choking smoke. A trooper alongside me was plucked from his saddle as though by an invisible hand, and I found myself drenched in a shower of blood. My little mare went surging ahead, crazy with pain. We were outdistancing Cardigan now. And even in that hell of death and gunfire, I remember, my stomach was asserting itself again, and I rode, yelling with panic and farting furiously at the same time. I couldn't hold my horse at all. It was all I could do to stay aboard as we raced onwards, and as I stared wildly ahead, I saw that we were a bare few hundred yards from the Russian batteries. The great black muzzles were staring me in the face, smoke wreathing up around them. But even as I saw the flame belching from them, I couldn't hear the crash of their discharge. It was all lost in the fearful, continuous, reverberating cannonade that surrounded us. There was no stopping my mad career, and I found myself roaring, "Please, for mercy," to the distant Russian gunners, crying, "Stop, stop, for God's sake, cease fire, damn you, and let me alone." I could see them plainly, crouching at their breeches, working furiously to reload and pour another torrent of death at us through the smoke. I raged and swore mindlessly at them and dragged out my sabre, thinking, "By heaven, if you finish me, I'll do my damnedest to take one of you with me, you filthy Russian scum." "And then," wrote that fatuous ass of a correspondent, "was seen with what nobility and power the gallant flashman rode, charging ahead even of his valiant chief, the death cry of the illustrious Nolan in his ears, his eye flashing terribly as he swung the sabre that had stemmed the horde at Jalalabad. He hurtled against the foe." Well, yes, you might put it that way. But my nobility and power was concentrated, in a moment of inspiration, in trying to swerve that maddened beast out of the fixed lines of the guns. I had just sense enough left for that. I tugged at the mane with my free hand. She swerved and stumbled, recovered, reared, and had me half out of the saddle. My innards were seized with a fresh spasm, and if I were a fanciful man, I swear I blew myself back astride of her. The ground shook beneath us with another exploding shell, knocking us sideways. I clung on, sobbing, and as the smoke cleared, Cardigan came thundering by, sabre thrust out ahead of his charger's ears, and I heard him hoarsely shouting, "Steady them, hold them in, close up and hold in." I tried to yell to him to halt, but he was going the wrong way. But my voice seemed to have gone. I turned in the saddle to shout or signal the men behind, and my God, what a sight it was! Half a dozen riderless horses at my very tail, crazy with fear, and behind them a score, God knows there didn't seem to be any more, of the 17th Lancers, some with hats gone, some streaked with blood, strung out any old how, glaring like madmen and tearing along. Empty saddles, shattered squadrons, all order gone, men and beasts going down by the second, the ground furrowing and spouting earth even as you watched. And still they came on, the lances of the 17th, and behind, the sabres of the 11th. just a fleeting instant thought I had, even in that inferno, remembering the brilliant cherry-pickers in splendid review. And there they were, tearing forward like a horde of hell-bound spectres. I had only a moment to look back. My mare was galloping like a thing demented, and as I steadied, there was Cardigan, waving his sabre and standing in his stirrups. The guns were only 100 yards away, almost hidden in a great billowing bank of smoke, a bank which kept glaring red as though some Lucifer were opening furnace doors deep inside it. There was no turning, no holding back, and even in that deafening thunder I could hear the sudden chorus of yells behind me as the torn remnant of the light brigade gathered itself for the final mad charge into the battery. I dug in my heels, yelling nonsense and brandishing my sabre, shot into the smoke with one final rip from my bowels and a prayer that my gallant little mare wouldn't career headlong into a gun muzzle, staggered at the fearful concussion of a gun exploding within a yard of me, and then we were through, into the open space behind the guns, leaping the limbers and ammunition boxes with the Russians scattering to let us through, and Cardigan a bare 2 yards away, reining his beast back almost on its haunches. And then for a moment everything seemed to happen very slowly. I can see it all so distinctly. Immediately to my left, and close enough to toss a biscuit, there was a squadron of Cossacks with their lances couched, but all immobile, staring as though in amazement. Almost under my mare's hooves there was a Russian gunner clutching a rammer, sprawling to get out of the way. He was stripped to the waist, I remember, and had a medal round his neck on a string. Ahead of me, perhaps 50 yards off, was a brilliant little group of mounted men who could only be staff officers, and right beside me, still stiff and upright as a lance at rest, was Cardigan. "By God," I thought, "you're through that without a scratch on you, damn you." And so, it crossed my mind, was I, for the moment. And then everything jerked into crazy speed again as the light brigade came careering out of the smoke, and the whole battery was suddenly a melee of rearing beasts, yelling maniacs, cracking pieces and flashing steel. I was in the final moments of Little Bighorn and the horror of Chilianwallah, which are among my nastiest recollections still. But for sheer murderous fury, I recall nothing like the mad few minutes when the battered rabble of the light brigade rode over that Russian battery. It was as though they'd gone mad, which in a sense they had. They slashed those Russian gun crews apart, sabering, lancing, pounding them down under hoof. I saw a corporal of the 17th drive his lance point 4 feet through a gunner's body and then leap from the saddle to tear at the fellow with his hands. Cardigan exchanging cuts with a mounted officer, troopers wrestling with Cossacks in the saddle, one of our hussars on foot whirling his sabre round his head and driving into a crowd of half a dozen, a Russian with his arm off at the elbow and a trooper still sabring him about the head. And then a Cossack came lumbering at me, roaring, with his lance couched to drive me through. But he was a handless clown and missed me by a yard. I howled and slashed him backhanded as he blundered by. And then I was buffeted clean out of the saddle and went rolling away, weaponless, beneath a gun limber. If I hadn't been scared witless, I dare say I'd have stayed where I was, meditating, getting rid of some more wind and generally taking a detached view. But in my panic I came scurrying out again, and there was George Paget, of all people, leaning from his saddle to grab my arm and swing me towards a riderless horse. I scrambled up, and George shouted, "Come on, Flash, you old savage, we can't lose you. I want another of your cheroots presently. Close here, fourth lights, close!" There was a swirl of troopers round us, glaring, smoke-blackened, bloody faces. A volley of commands, someone thrust a sabre into my hand, and George was crying, "What a bloody pickle! We must cut our way home. Follow me." And off we pounded, gasping and blinded, at his heels. I must have been near stupid with panic, for all I could think was, one more rush, just one more, and we'll be out of this hellhole and back into the valley. God knows, that was a horrifying prospect enough, but at least we were riding in the right direction, and Providence or something had been on my side so far, and if only my luck would hold, I might come through and reach the Sapoon and the camp beyond it, and my bed, and a ship, and London, and never, never go near a bloody uniform again. "Halt!" bawls George, and I thought, I don't care, this is one gallant cavalryman who isn't halting for anything. I've had enough, and if I'm the only man who goes streaking back up that valley, leaving his comrades in the lurch, to hell with it. I put my head down and my heels in, thrust out my sabre to discourage any fool who got in the way, and charged ahead for all I was worth. I heard George bawling behind me, "Halt! No, Flash, no!" and thought, "Carry on, George, and be damned to you." I fairly flew over the turf. The shouting died behind me, and I raised my head and looked straight at what appeared to be the entire Russian army drawn up in review order. There were great hideous ranks of the brutes, with Cossacks dead ahead, not 20 yards off. I had only a fleeting glimpse of amazed, bearded faces. There wasn't a hope of stopping, and then with a blasphemous yell of despair, I plunged into them, horse, sabre, and all. Picture, if you can bear it, reader, as that idiot journalist put it, the agony of Lord George Paget and his gallant remnant in that moment. They had fought like heroes in the battery. Lord George himself had plucked the noble flashman from bloody hand-to-hand conflict. They had rallied and ridden on through the battery. Lord George had given the halt preparatory to wheeling about and charging back into the battery in the valley beyond, where ultimate safety lay. Picture, then, their anguish when that great heart, too full to think of safety or of aught but the cruel destruction of so many of his comrades, chose instead to launch himself alone against the embattled ranks of Muscovy. Sabre aloft, proud defiance on his lips, he chose the course that honour pointed, and rode like some champion of old to find death on the sabres of his enemies. Well, I've always said if you get the press on your side, you're halfway there. I've never bothered to correct that glowing tribute until now. Seems almost a shame to do it at last. I don't remember which journal it appeared in. Bell's Sporting Life, for all I know. But I don't doubt it caused many a manly tear to start, and many a fair bosom to heave when they read it. In the meantime, I was doing a bit in the manly tear and bosom-heaving line myself, with my horse foundering under me, my sabre flying from my hand, and my sorely tried carcass sprawling on the turf, while all those peasant horsemen shied back, growling and gaping, and then closed in again, staring down at me in that dull, astonished way that Russians have. I just lay there, gasping like a salmon on the bank, waiting for the lance points to come scurrying down on me and babbling weakly, "Camarade, ami, sart, amigo, oh God, what's the Russian for friend?" Chapter 5. Being a prisoner of war has its advantages, or used to. If you were a British officer taken by a civilized foe, you could expect to be rather better treated than your adversary would treat his own people. He would use you as a guest, entertain you, be friendly, and not bother over much about confining you. He might ask your parole not to try to escape, but not usually. Since you would be exchanged for one of his own people at the first opportunity, there wasn't much point in running off. Mind you, I think we British fared rather better than most. They respected us and knew we didn't make war in a beastly fashion like these Balkan fellows, so they treated us accordingly. But a Russian taken by the Poles, or an Austrian by the Itais, or even a Confederate by the Yankees, well, he might not come off quite so comfortably. I'm told it's all changing now, and that war is no longer a gentleman's game, as though it ever was, and that among the new professionals, a prisoner's a prisoner, so damn well cage him up. I don't know. We treated each other decently, and weren't one jot more incompetent than this Sandhurst and shop crowd. Look at that young pup Kitchener. What that fella needs is a woman or two. At all events, no one's ever treated me better, by and large, than the Russians did. Although I don't think it was kindness, but ignorance, from the moment I measured my length among those Cossacks, I found myself being regarded with something like awe. It wasn't just the light brigade fiasco, which had impressed them tremendously, but a genuine uncertainty where the English were concerned. They seemed to look on us as though we were men from the moon, or made of dynamite and so liable to go off if scratched. The truth is, they're such a dull, wary lot of peasants, the ordinary folk and soldiers, that is, that they go in fear of anything strange until someone tells them what to do about it. In those days, of course, most of them were slaves, except for the Cossacks, and behaved as such. I'll have more to say about this, but for the moment it's enough to note that the Cossacks kept away from me, glowering, until one of their officers jumped down, helped me to my feet, and accepted my surrender. I doubt if he understood a word I said, for I was too shocked and confused to be coherent, even if I'd spoken Russian, which I didn't much at that time. He led me through the crowd, and once I'd realized that they weren't going to do me violence, and that I was safely out of that hellish maelstrom, I set myself to collect my wits and consider what should be done. They stuck me in a tent with two massive Cossacks at the entrance, Black Sea Cossacks, as I learned later, with those stringy, long-haired caps and scarlet lances. And there I sat, listening to the growing chatter outside, and every now and then an officer would stick his face in and regard me, and then withdraw. I was still feeling fearfully sick and giddy, and my right ear seemed to have gone deaf with the cannonading. But as I leaned against the pole, shuddering, one thought kept crowding gloriously into my mind. I was alive, and in one piece. I'd survived, God knew how, the shattering of the Light Brigade, to say nothing of the earlier actions of the day. It seemed like a year since I'd stood with Campbell's Highlanders, though it was a bare 5 hours ago. "You've come through again, my boy," I kept thinking. "You're going to live." "That being the case, head up, look alive, and keep your eyes open." Presently in came a little dapper chap in a fine white uniform, black boots, and a helmet with a crowned eagle. "Lansky," says he in good French, which most educated Russians spoke, by the way. "Major, cuirassiers of the guard, whom have I the pleasure of addressing?" "Flashman," says I. "Colonel, 17th Lancers." "Enchanted," says he, bowing. "May I request that you accompany me to General Liprandi, who is most anxious to make the acquaintance of such a distinguished and gallant officer?" Well, he couldn't have said fairer. I bucked up at once, and he led me out, through a curious throng of officers and staff hangers-on, into a great tent, where about a dozen senior officers were waiting, with a genial-looking, dark-whiskered fellow in a splendid sable coat, whom I took to be Liprandi, seated behind a table. They stopped talking at once, a dozen pairs of eager eyes fixed on me as Lansky presented me, and I stood up, tall, ragged, muck-smeared though I was, and just stared over Liprandi's head, clicking my heels. He came round the table right up to me and said, also in excellent French, "Your pardon, Colonel. Permit me." And to my astonishment, he stuck his nose up close to my lips, sniffing. "What the devil?" cries I, stepping back. "A thousand pardons, sir," says he. "It is true, gentlemen," turning to his staff, "not the suspicion of liquor." And they all began to buzz again, staring at me. "You are perfectly sober," says Liprandi, "and so, as I have ascertained, are your troopers who have been taken prisoner. I confess I am astonished. Will you perhaps enlighten us, Colonel, what was the explanation of that extraordinary action by your light cavalry an hour ago? Believe me," he went on, "I seek no military intelligence from you, no advantage of information, but it is beyond precedent, beyond understanding. Why in God's name did you do it?" Now, I didn't know at that time precisely what we had done. I guessed we must have lost 3/4 of the Light Brigade by a hideous mistake, but I couldn't know that I'd just taken part in the most famous cavalry action ever fought, one that was to sound round the world, and that even eyewitnesses could scarcely believe. The Russians were amazed. It seemed to them we must have been drunk or drugged or mad. They weren't to guess that it had been a ghastly accident, and I wasn't going to enlighten them, so I said, "Ah, well, you know, it was just to teach you fellows to keep your distance." At this they exclaimed and shook their heads and swore, and Liprandi looked bewildered and kept muttering, "500 sabres, to what end?" And they crowded round, plying me with questions. "All very friendly, mind," so that I began to get my bounce back and played it off as though it were just another day's work. What they couldn't fathom was how we'd held together all the way to the guns and hadn't broken or turned back, even with 4 saddles empty out of 5. So I just told them, "We're British cavalry," simple as that, and looked them in the eye. It was true, too, even if no one had less right to say it than I. At that they stamped and swore again, incredulously, and one huge chap with a beard began to weep and insisted on embracing me, stinking of garlic as he was. And Liprandi called for brandy and demanded of me what we in England called our light cavalry. And when I told them, they all raised their glasses and shouted together, "Die Light Brigade!" and dashed down their glasses and crowned them underfoot, and embraced me again, laughing and shouting and patting me on the head, while I, the unworthy recipient, looked pretty bluff and offhand and said, "No, damn it all, it was nothing, just our usual form, don't you know?" I should have felt shame, doubtless, at the thought that I, old Windy Harry, was getting the plaudits and the glory, but you know me. Anyway, I'd been there, hadn't I, all the way. Should I be disqualified just because I was babbling scared? After that, it was all booze and good fellowship, and when I'd been washed and given a change of clothes, Leprandi gave me a slap-up dinner with his staff, and the champagne flowed. French, you may be certain. These Russians know how to go to war. And they were all full of attention and admiration and a thousand questions, but every now and then they would fall silent and look at me in that strange way that every survivor of the charge has come to recognize, respectfully and almost with reverence, but with a hint of suspicion, as though you weren't quite canny. Indeed, their hospitality was so fine that night that I began to feel regretful at the thought that I'd probably be exchanged in the next day or two, and would find myself back in that lousy, fever-ridden camp under Sevastopol. It's a curious thing, but my belly, which had been in such wicked condition all day, felt right as rain after that dinner. We all got gloriously tight, drinking healths, and the bearded garlic giant and Lansky carried me to bed, and we all fell on the floor, roaring and laughing. As I crawled onto my blankets, I had only a moment's blurred recollection of the sound of cannonade and ranks of Highlanders and Scarlet's gaudy scarf, and the headlong gallop down the Sapoon, and Cardigan cantering slowly and erect, and those belching guns all whirling together in a great smoky confusion. And it all seemed past and unimportant as I slid away into unconsciousness and slept like a winter hedgehog. They didn't exchange me. They kept me for a couple of weeks, confined in a cottage at Yalta, with two musket men on the door, and a Russian colonel of horse pioneers to walk the little garden with me for exercise. And then I was visited by Radzivill, a very decent chap on Leprandi's staff who spoke English and knew London well. He was terribly apologetic, explaining that there wasn't a suitable exchange, since I was a staff man, and a pretty rare catch. I didn't believe this. We'd taken senior Russian officers every bit as important as I, at the Alma, and I wondered exactly why they wanted to keep me prisoner. But there was no way of finding out, of course. Not that it concerned me much. I didn't mind a holiday in Russia, being treated as an honoured guest rather than a prisoner. For Radzivill hastened to reassure me that what they intended to do was send me across the Crimea to Kerch, and then by boat to mainland Russia, where I'd be safely tucked away on a country estate. The advantage of this was that I would be so far out of harm's way that escape would be impossible. I tried to look serious and knowing when he said this, as though I'd been contemplating running off to rejoin the bloody battle again, and I could lead a nice, easy life without over many restrictions until the war was over, which couldn't be long anyway. I've learned to make the best of things, so I accepted without demur, packed up my few traps, which consisted of my cleaned and mended Lancer blues and a few shirts and things which Radzivill gave me, and prepared to go where I was taken. I was quite looking forward to it. Fool that I was. Before I went Radzivill, no doubt meaning to be kind, but in fact just being an infernal nuisance, arranged for me to visit those survivors of the Light Brigade who'd been taken prisoner and were in confinement down near Yalta. I didn't want to see them much, but I couldn't refuse. There were about 30 of them in a big stuffy shed, and not above 6 of them unwounded. The others were in cots, with bandaged heads and slings, some with limbs off, lying like wax dummies, one or two plainly just waiting to die, and all of them looking desperate hangdog. The moment I went inside, I wished I hadn't come. It's this kind of thing, the stale smell of blood, the wasted faces, the hushed voices, the awful hopeless tiredness that makes you understand what a hellish thing war is. Worse than a battlefield, worse than the blood and the mud and the smoke and the steel, is the dank misery of a hospital of wounded men. And this place was a good deal better than most. Russians ain't clean by any means, but the ward they'd made for our fellows was better than our own medical folk could have arranged at Balaclava. Would you believe it, when I came in, they raised a cheer. The pale faces lit up. Those that could struggled upright in bed, and their non-com, who wasn't wounded, threw me a salute.
"Royan, sir," says he, "Troop Sergeant Major, 8th Hussars. Sorry to see you're took, sir, but glad to see you well."
I thanked him and shook hands, and then went round, giving a word here and there, as you're bound to do, and feeling sick at the sight of the pain and disfigurement. It could have been me, lying there with a leg off, on my face stitched like a football.
"Not taking any arms, sir, as you see," says Ryan. "The grub ain't much, but it feels. You're being treated proper yourself, sir, if I may make so bold." "Ah, that's good, that is. I'm glad to hear that. You'll be getting exchanged, I reckon." "No? Well, blow me, who'd have thought that? I reckon they doesn't want to let you go, though. Why, when we heard t'other day as you'd been took, old Dick there, that's him, sir, with the sabre cut, he says, 'That's good news for the Ruskies. Old Flash is worth a squadron any day.' Begging your pardon, sir." "That's mighty kind of friend Dick," says I, "but I fear I'm not worth very much at present, you know." They laughed, such a thin laugh, and growled and said, "Gone!" And Ryan dropped his voice, glancing towards where Lansky loitered by the door, and says softly, "I knows better, sir, and there's half a dozen of us sound enough here to be worth 20 of these Rusky chaps. If you was to say the word, sir, I reckon we could break our way out of here, grab a few sabres, and cut our way back to the army. It can't be above 20 miles to Sevastopol. We could do it, sir. The boys is game for it, and—" "Silence, Ryan," says I won't hear of it." This was one of these dangerous bastards, I could see, full of duty and desperate notions. "What, break away and leave our wounded comrades? No, no, that would never do. I'm surprised at you." He flushed. "I'm sorry, sir, I was just—" "I know, my boy." I put a hand on his shoulder. "You want to do your duty as a soldier should, but you see it can't be, and you can take pride in what you've done already, all of you can." I thought a few patriotic words wouldn't do any harm. "You are stout fellows, all of you. England is proud of you. And we'll let you go to the poorhouse in time, or sell laces at street corners," I thought to myself. "Old Jim the Bear'll be proud and all,"
pipes up one chap with a bandage swathing his head and eye, and I saw the blood-stained cherry-picker pants at the foot of his cot.
"They do say as his lordship got out the battery, sir. Dryden there was picked up by the Ruskies in the valley, and he saw Lord Cardigan going back arrowards. Says he had a bloody sabre too, but wasn't hurt himself."
That was bad news. I could have borne the loss of Cardigan any day.
"Good old Jim. Ain't he the one, though? He's a good old commander and a gentleman, even if he is an 11th Hussar," says Ryan.
And they all laughed and looked shy at me because they knew I'd been a cherry-picker once. There was a very pale, thin young face in the cot nearest the door, and as I was turning away, he croaked out in a little whisper,
"Colonel Flashman, sir, Troop Sergeant Major was saying it never happened afore, cavalry charging a battery with no support and taking it. Never happened nowheres in any war, sir. Is that right, sir?"
I didn't know, but I'd certainly never heard of it, so I said, "I believe that's right. I think it may be." He smiled.
"That's good, then. Thank ye, sir."
And he lay back with his eyelids twitching, breathing very quietly. "Well," says I, "goodbye, Ryan. Goodbye, all of you. Keep your spirits up. We'll all be going home soon."
"When the Ruskies is beat,"
cries someone, and Ryan says,
"Three cheers for the Colonel."
And they all cheered feebly and shouted, "Good old Flash Harry." And the man with the patched eye began to sing, and they all took it up. And as I drove off with Lansky, I heard the words of the old Light Brigade canter fading behind me. "In the place of water we'll drink ale, and pay no reckoning on the nail. No man for debt shall go to jail, while he can Gary Owen Hale." I've heard it from Afghanistan to Whitehall, from the African veldt to drunken hunting parties in Rutland. Heard it sounded on penny whistles by children and roared out in full-throated chorus by Custer's 7th on the day of greasy grass. And there were survivors of the Light Brigade singing on that day, too. But it always sounds bitter on my ears because I think of those brave, deluded, pathetic, bloody fools in that Russian shed.
with their mangled bodies and lost limbs, all for a shilling a day in a pauper's grave. And yet they thought Cardigan, who'd have flogged them for a rusty spur, and would seem them murdered under the Russian guns because he hadn't wit and manhood enough to tell Lucan to take his order to hell. They thought he was a good old commander, and they even cheered me, who'd have turned tail on them at the click of a bolt. Mind you, I'm harmless by comparison. I don't send them off stuffed with lies and rubbish to get killed and maimed for nothing except a politician's vanity or a manufacturer's profit. Oh, I'll sham it with the best in public and sport my tinware, but I know what I am, and there's no room for honest pride in me, you see. But if there was, just for a little bit, along with the disgust and hatred and selfishness, I'd keep it for them, those 700 British sabres. It must be the drink talking. That's the worst of it. Whenever I think back to Balaclava, there's nothing for it but the booze. It's not that I feel guilt or regret or shame. They don't count beside feeling alive, anyway, even if I were capable of them. It's just that I don't really understand Balaclava even now. Oh, I can understand, without sharing, most kinds of courage, that which springs from rage or fear or greed or even love. I've had a bit of them myself. Anyone can show brave if his children or his woman are threatened. Mind you, if the hosts of Midian were assailing my little nest, offering to ravish my loved one, my line would be to say to her, "Look, you jolly him along, old girl, and look your best, while I circle round to a convenient rock with my rifle." But are these emotions that come of anger or terror or desire really bravery at all? I doubt it myself. But what happened in the North Valley under those Russian guns, all for nothing, that's bravery, and you may take the word of a true blue coward for it. It's beyond my ken, anyway, thank God. So I'll say no more of it, or of Balaclava, which, as far as my Russian adventure is concerned, was really just an unpleasant prelude. Enough's enough. Lord Tennyson may have the floor for me. The journey from Yalta through the woody hills to Kerch was not noteworthy. Once you've seen a corner of the Crimea, you've seen it all. And it's not really Russia. From Kerch, where a singularly surly and uncommunicative French-speaking civilian took me in charge, with a couple of dragoons to remind me what I was, we went by sloop across the Azov Sea to Taganrog, a dirty little port, and joined the party of an imperial courier whose journey lay the same way as ours. Aha, thinks I, we'll travel in style. Which shows how mistaken one can be. The courier was evidently in no hurry, for we crawled along at an abominably slow pace, although telegrees can travel at a tremendous clip when they want to, with a bell clanging in front, and everyone scattering out of their way. This book is continued on cassette 4.